brother is not so clever as he thinks. A clever man would have left from Old Town even if it meant a longer voyage. In Old Town he might have gone unrecognized. Ariane had friends amongst the orphans of the Planky Town, and some had grown curious as to why a prince and a lord's son might be travelling under false names and seeking passage across the narrow sea. One of them had crept through a window of a night, tickled the lock on Quentin's little strongbox, and found the scrolls within. Ariane would have given much and more to know that this secret trip across the narrow sea was Quentin's own doing, and his alone. But parchments he had carried had been sealed with the sun and spear of Dawn. Garen's cousin had not dared break the seal to read them, but,
"Princess!"
Sir Geraldine stood behind her, half in the starlight and half in shadow.
"How was your piss?"
Ariane inquired archly.
The Sands were duly grateful.
Dane put a foot upon the head of a statue that might have been the maiden until the Sands had scoured her face away.
It occurred to me, as I was pissing, that this plan of yours may not yield what you want.
And what is it I want, sir?
The Sand Snakes freed. Vengeance for Oberon and a liar. Do I know the song? You want a little taste of lion blood.
That, and my birthright. I want Sunspear, and my father's seat. I want Dawn. I want justice.
Call it what you will. Crowning the Lannister girl is a hollow gesture. She will never sit the Iron Throne, nor will you get the war you want. The lion is not so easily provoked.
Sir Gerald drew his sword. It glimmered in the starlight, sharp as lies.
This is how you start a war, not with a crown of gold, but with a blade of steel.
I am no murderer of children. Put that away. Marcella is under my protection, and Sir Ares will permit no harm to come to his precious princess. You know that?
No, my lady. What I know is that Danes have been killing Oakhearts for several thousand years.
His arrogance took her breath away. It seems to me that Oakhearts have been killing Danes for just as long.
We all have our family traditions.
Darkstar sheathed his sword.
The moon is rising, and I see your paragon approaching.
His eyes were sharp. The horseman on the tall grey palfrey did indeed prove to be Sir Ares, white cloak fluttering bravely as he spurred across the sand. Princess Marcella rode pillion behind him, swaddled in a cowled robe that hid her golden curls. As Sir Ares helped her from the saddle, Drey went to one knee before her.
"Your Grace, my Lady Liege,"
Spotted Silver knelt beside him.
"My Queen, I am your man."
Garen dropped to both knees. Confused, Marcella clutched Ares Oakheart by the arm.
"Why do they call me Grace?"
she asked in a plaintive voice.
"Sir Ares, what is this place, and who are they?"
Has he told her naught? Ariane moved forward in a swirl of silk, smiling to put the child at ease.
"They are my true and loyal friends, your Grace, and would be your friends as well."
"Princess Ariane?"
The girl threw her arms around her.
"Why do they call me Queen? Did something bad happen to Tommen?"
"He fell in with evil men, your Grace,"
Ariane said, "and I fear they have conspired with him to steal your throne."
"My throne? You mean the Iron Throne?"
The girl was more confused than ever.
"He never stole that. Tommen is
younger than you, surely?"
"I'm older by a year."
"That means the Iron Throne by right is yours," Ariane said.
"Your brother is only a little boy. You must not blame him. He has bad counselors. But you have friends. May I have the honor of presenting them?"
She took the child by the hand.
"Your Grace, I give you Sir Andrew Dolt, the heir to Lemonwood."
"My friends call me Drey," he said, "and I should be greatly honored if your Grace would do the same." Though Drey had an open face and an easy smile, Marcella regarded him warily.
"Until I know you, I must call you sir."
"'Whatever name your grace prefers, I am her man.'
Silva cleared her throat, till Arianne said, "'Might I present Lady Silva Santigar, my queen? "'My dearest spotted Silva.'
"'Why do they call you that?'
Marcella asked. "'For my freckles, your grace,' Silva answered. "'Though they all pretend it is because I am the heir to Spotswood.'
Garen was next, a loose-limbed, swarthy, long-nosed fellow, with a jade stud in one ear.
"'Here is gay Garen of the Orphans, who makes me laugh,' said Arianne. "'His mother was my wet nurse.'
"'I am sorry she is dead,' Marcella said. "'She's not, sweet queen.'
Garen flashed the golden tooth Arianne had bought him to replace the one she'd broken.
"'I'm of the Orphans of the Green Blood.' "'Is what my lady means.'
Marcella would have time enough to learn the history of the orphans on her voyage up the river. Arianne led her queen-to-be to the final member of her little band. "'Last but first in valour, I give you Sir Gerald Deane, a knight of Starfall.' Sir Gerald went to one knee. The moonlight shone in his dark eyes as he studied the child coolly.
"'There was an Arthur Dane,' Marcella said. "'He was a knight of the King's Guard in the days of Mad King Ares. "'He was the Sword of the Morning. He is dead. "'Are you the Sword of the Morning now?' "'No. Men call me Darkstar, and I am of the night.'
"'Arianne drew the child away.
"'Oh, you must be hungry. "'We have dates and cheese and olives and lemon sweet to drink.' You ought not to eat or drink too much, though. After a little rest we must ride. Out here on the sands it is always best to travel by night, before the sun ascends the sky. It's kinder to the horses.
And the riders, Spotted Silver said. Come, your grace, warm yourself. I shall be honoured if you would let me serve you.
As she led the princess to the fire, Arianne found Sir Gerald behind her.
My house goes back 10,000 years, until the dawn of days, he complained. Why is it that my cousin is the only Dane that anyone remembers?
He was a great knight, Sir Ares Oakheart put in.
He had a great sword,
Darkstar said.
And a great heart, Sir Ares took Arianne by the arm. Princess, I beg a moment's word.
Come. She led Sir Ares deeper into the ruin. Beneath his cloak, the knight wore a cloth of gold doublet embroidered with the three green oak leaves of his house. On his head was a light steel helm, topped by a jagged spike, wound about with a yellow scarf in the Dornish fashion. He might have passed for any knight, but for the cloak. Of shimmering white silk it was, pale as moonlight and airy as a breeze.
A Kingsguard cloak beyond all doubt. The gallant fool.
How much does the child know?
Little enough. Before we left King's Landing, her uncle reminded her that I was her protector, and that any commands that I might give her were meant to keep her safe. She has heard them in the streets as well, shouting out for vengeance. She knew this was no game. The girl is brave and wise beyond her years. She did all I asked of her, and never asked a question.
The knight took her arm, glanced about, lowered his voice.
And there are other tidings you should hear. Tywin Lannister is dead.
That was a shock.
Dead? Murdered by the imp. The queen has assumed the regency.
Has she? A woman on the Iron Throne?
Arianne thought about that for a moment and decided... It was all to the good. If the lords of the Seven Kingdoms grew accustomed to Queen Cersei's rule, it would be that much easier for them to bend their knees to Queen Marcella. And Lord Tywin had been a dangerous foe. Without him, Dorne's enemies would be much weaker.
Lannisters are killing Lannisters. How sweet!
What became of the dwarf?
He's fled, Sir Aerys said. Cersei is offering a lordship to whosoever delivers her his head.
In a tiled inner courtyard, half buried by the drifting sands, he pushed her back against a column to kiss her.
and his hand went to her breast. He kissed her long and hard, and would have pushed her skirts up, but Ariane broke free of him, laughing.
"I see that queen-making excites you, sir, but we have no time for this. Later, I promise you."
She touched his cheek.
"Did you meet with any problems?"
"Only Tristain. He wanted to sit beside Marcella's bedside and play Cervassi with her.
He had red spots when he was 4, I told you. You can only get it once. You should have put out that Marcella was suffering from grayscale. That would have kept him well away.
Had a boy, perhaps, but not your father's maester."
"Kallia," she said. "Did he try to see her?"
"Not once. I described the red spots on her face. He said that nothing could be done until the disease had run its course, and gave me a pot of salve to soothe her itching."
No one under 10 ever died of red spots, but it could be mortal in adults, and Maester Kallioth had never suffered it as a child. Ariane learned that when she suffered her own spots at 8.
"Good," she said. "And the handmaid, is she convincing?"
From a distance. The imp picked her for this purpose, over many girls of nobler birth. Marcella helped her curl her hair and painted the dots on her face herself. They are distant kin. Lannisport teams with Lannies, Lannettes, Lantels, and lesser Lannisters, and half of them have that yellow hair. Dressed in Marcella's bedrobe, with the maester's salve smeared across her face, she might even have fooled me in a dim light. It was a deal harder to find a man to take my place. Dake is closest to my height, but he's too fat, so I put Rolder in my armor and told him to keep his visor down. The man is 3 inches shorter than I am, but perhaps no one will notice if I'm not there to stand beside him. He'll keep to Marcella's chambers in any case.
All we need is a few days. By that time the princess will be beyond my father's reach.
Where?
He drew her close and nuzzled at her neck.
It's time you told me the rest of the plan, don't you think?
She laughed, pushing him away.
No, it's time we rode.
The moon had crowned the Moon Maid as they set out from the dust-dry ruins of Shandystone, striking south and west. Ariane and Sir Aerys took the lead, with Marcella on a frisky mare between them. Garen followed close behind, with Spotted Silver, whilst her 2 Dornish knights took the rear.
"We are 7,
Ariane realized as they rode. She had not thought of that before, but it seemed a good omen for their cause.
7 riders on their way to glory. One day the singers will make us all immortal.
Drey had wanted a larger party, but that might have attracted unwelcome attention, and every additional man doubled the risk of betrayal.
That much my father taught me, at the least.
Even when he was younger and stronger, Doran Martell had been a cautious man, much given to silences and secrets.
It is time he put his burdens down, but I will suffer no slights to his honour or his person.
She would return him to his water gardens, to live out what years remained him, surrounded by laughing children and the smell of limes and oranges.
Yes, and Quentin can keep him company. Once I crown Marcella and free the sand snakes, old Dorn will rally to my banners.
The Ironwoods might declare for Quentin, but alone they were no threat. If they went over to Tommen and the Lannisters, she would have Darkstar destroy them root and branch.
"I am tired,"
Marcella complained, after several hours in the saddle.
"Is it much farther? Where are we going?"
"Princess Ariane is taking your grace to a place where you'll be safe,"
Sir Aerys assured her.
"It's a long journey," Ariane said, "but it will go easier once we reach the Green Blood. Some of Garen's people will meet us there, the orphans of the river. They live on boats and pull them up and down the Green Blood and its vessels, fishing and picking fruit, doing whatever work needs doing."
"Aye," Garen called out cheerfully, "and we sing and play and dance on water, and know much and more of healing. My mother is the best midwife in Westeros, and my father can cure warts."
"'How can you be orphans if you have mothers and fathers?'
the girl asked. "'They are the Rhoyna,' Ariane explained, "'and their mother was the River Rhoyne.'
Marcella did not understand.
"'I thought you were the Rhoyna. You Dornishmen, I mean.
"'We are in part, Your Grace. Namira's blood is in me, along with that of Mors Martell, the Dornish lord she married. On the day they wed, Namira fired her ships, so her people would understand that there could be no going back. Most were glad to see those flames, for their voyagings had been long and terrible before they came to Dorne, and many and more had been lost to storm, disease, and slavery. There were a few who mourned, however. They did not love this dry red land or its seven-faced god, so they clung to their old ways, hammered boats together from the hulks of the burned ships, and became the orphans of the green blood. The mother in their songs is not our mother, but Mother Rhoyne, whose waters nourish them from the dawn of days.
I'd heard the Rhoyna has some turtle god, said Sir Aerys.
The old man of the river is a lesser god, said Garin. He was born from Mother River too, and fought the Crab King to win dominion over all who dwelt beneath the flowing waters.
Oh, said Marcella.
I understand you fought some mighty battles too, Your Grace, said Dre, in his most cheerful voice. It is said you show our brave Prince Tristain no mercy at the Cervassi table.
He always sets his squares up the same way, with all the mountains in the front and his elephants in the passes, said Marcella. So I send my dragon through to eat his elephants.
Does your handmaid play the game as well? Asked Dre.
Rosamond? Asked Marcella. No, I tried to teach her, but she says the rules were too hard.
She is a Lannister as well, said Lady Silver.
A Lannister of Lannisport, not a Lannister of Castle Rock. Her hair is the same colour as mine, but straight instead of curly. Rosamond doesn't truly favour me, but when she dresses up in my clothes, people who don't know us think she's me.
You have done this before, then?
Oh, yes. We traded places on this sea swift on the way to Braavos. Scepter Eglantine put brown dye in my hair. She said we were doing it as a game, but it was meant to keep me safe in case the ship was taken by my Uncle Stannis.
The girl was plainly growing tired, so Ariane called a halt. They watered the horses once again, rested for a bit, and had some cheese and fruit. Marcella split an orange with spotted silver, whilst Garin ate olives and spit the stones at Dre. Ariane had hoped to reach the river before the sun came up, but they had started much later than she'd planned, so they were still in the saddle when the eastern sky turned red. Darkstar cantered up beside her.
Princess, he said, I set a faster pace unless you mean to kill the child after all. We have no tents, and by day the sands are cruel.
I know the sands as well as you do, sir, she told him. All the same, she did as he suggested. It was hard in their mounts, but better she should lose six horses than one princess.
Soon enough the wind came gusting from the west, hot and dry and full of grit. Ariane drew her veil across her face. It was made of shimmering silk, pale green above and yellow below, the colours blending into one another. Small green pearls gave it weight, and rattled softly against each other as she rode.
"'I know why my princess wears a veil,' Sir Aerys said, as she was fastening it to the temples of her copper helm. "'Elsewise her beauty would outshine the sun above.'
She had to laugh.
No, your princess wears a veil to keep the glare out of her eyes and the sand out of her mouth. You should do the same, sir.
She wondered how long her white knight had been polishing his ponderous gallantry. Sir Aerys was pleasant company abed, but wit and he were strangers. Her Dornish men covered their faces as she did, and spotted silver helped veil the little princess from the sun.
But Sir Aerys stayed stubborn. Before long the sweat was running down his face and his cheeks had taken on a rosy blush. "A much longer and he will cook in those heavy clothes," she reflected. He would not be the first. In centuries past many a host had come down from the prince's pass with banners streaming, only to wither and broil on the hot red Dornish sands. The arms of House Martell display the sun and spear, the Dornishman's two favoured weapons. The young dragon had once written in the boastful Conquest of Dawn, but of the two the sun is more deadly. Thankfully they did not need to cross the deep sands, but only a sliver of the dry lands. When Arianne spied a hawk wheeling high above them, against a cloudless sky, she knew the worst was behind them. Soon they came upon a tree. It was a gnarled and twisted thing, with as many thorns as leaves, of the sort called sand beggars. But it meant they were not far from water. "We're almost there, Your Grace," Garen told Marcella, cheerfully, when they spied more sand beggars up ahead, a thicket of them growing all around the dry bed of a stream. The sun was beating down like a fiery hammer, but it did not matter with their journey at its end. They stopped to water the horses again, drank deep from their skins, and wet their veils, then mounted for the last push. Within half a league they were riding over devil grass and past olive groves. Beyond a line of stony hills the grass grew greener and more lush, and there were lemon orchards, watered by a spider's web of old canals. Garen was the first to spy the river glimmering green. He gave a shout and raced ahead. Arianne Martell had crossed the Mander once, when she had gone with three of the sand snakes to visit Tyene's mother. Compared to that mighty waterway, the green blood was scarcely worthy of the name of river. Yet it remained the life of Dawn. It took its name from the murky green of its sluggish waters. But as they approached, the sunlight seemed to turn those waters gold. She had seldom seen a sweeter sight.
"The next part should be slow and simple," she thought. "Up the green blood, and unto the Vaith, as far as a pole boat can go."
That would give her time enough to prepare Marcella for all that was to come. Beyond Vaith, the deep sands waited. They would need help from Sandstone and the Hell Halt to make that crossing, but she did not doubt that it would be forthcoming. The Red Viper had been fostered at Sandstone, and Prince Oberyn's paramour, Ilaria Sand, was Lord Ulla's natural daughter. Four of the Sand Snakes were his granddaughters.
"I will crown Marcella at the Hell Halt and raise my banners there."
They found the boat half a league downstream, hidden beneath the drooping branches of a great green willow. Lower roof and wide abeam, the pole boats had hardly any draught to speak of. The young dragon had disparaged them as hovels built on rafts, but that was hardly fair. All but the poorest orphan boats were wonderfully carved and painted. This one was done in shades of green, with a curved wooden tiller shaped like a mermaid, and fish faces peering through her rails. Poles and ropes and jars of olive oil cluttered her decks. An iron lantern swung fore and aft. Arianne saw no orphans.
"Where is her crew?" she wondered.
Garen reined up beneath the willow.
"Wake up, ye fish-eyed lackabeds," he called as he leapt down from the saddle. "Your queen is here, and wants her royal welcome. Come up, come out. We'll have some songs and sweet wine. My mouth is set for—"
The door on the pole boat slammed open. Out into the sunlight stepped Ario Hotar, long axe in hand. Garen jerked to a halt. Arianne felt as though an axe had caught her in the belly.
It was not supposed to end this way. This was not supposed to happen.
When she heard Dre say, "There's the lost face I hope to see," she knew she had to act.
"Away!"
she cried, vaulting back into the saddle.
"Aerys, protect the princess!"
Hotar thumped the butt of his long axe upon the deck. Behind the ornate rails of the pole boat, a dozen guardsmen rose, armed with throwing spears or crossbows. Still more appeared atop the cabin.
"Heel, my princess," the captain called, "else we must slay all but the child and yourself, by your father's word."
Princess Marcella sat motionless upon her mount. Garen backed slowly from the pole boat, his hands in the air. Grey unbuckled his sword belt.
"Yielding seems to be the wisest course," he called to Ariane,
as his sword thumped to the ground.
"No!"
Sir Ares Oakheart put his horse between Ariane and the crossbows, his blade shining silver in his hand. He had unslung his shield and slipped his left arm through the straps.
"You will not take her, whilst I still draw breath."
"You reckless fool," was all that Ariane had time to think.
"What do you think you're doing?"
Darkstar's laughter rang out.
Are you blind or stupid, Oakheart? There are too many. Put up your sword."
"Do as he says, Sir Ares," Drey urged.
"We are taken, sir," Ariane might have called out. "Your death will not free us. If you love your princess, yield." But when she tried to speak, the words caught in her throat. Sir Ares Oakheart gave her one last longing look, then put his golden spurs into his horse and charged. He rode headlong for the pole boat, his white cloak streaming behind him. Ariane Martell had never seen anything half so gallant or half so stupid.
"No!"
she shrieked, but she had found her tongue too late. A crossbow thrummed, then another. Hotar bellowed a command. At such close range, the White Knight's armor had as well been made of parchment. The first bolt punched right through his heavy oaken shield, pinning it to his shoulder. The second grazed his temple. A thrown spear took Sir Ares' mount in the flank, yet still the horse came on, staggering as he hit the gangplank.
"No!"
some girl was shouting, some foolish little girl.
"No, please, this was not supposed to happen."
She could hear Marcella shrieking too, her voice shrill with fear. Sir Ares' longsword slashed right and left, and two spearmen went down. His horse reared and kicked a crossbowman in the face as he was trying to reload. But the other crossbowmen were firing, feathering the big courser with their quarrels. The bolts hit home so hard they knocked the horse sideways. His legs went out from under him and sent him crashing down the deck. Somehow Ares Oakheart leapt free. He even managed to keep hold of his sword. He struggled to his knees beside his dying horse, and found Ariohotar standing over him. The White Knight raised his blade too slowly. Hotar's long axe took his right arm off at the shoulder, spun away, spraying blood, and came flashing back again in a terrible two-handed slash that removed the head of Ares Oakheart and sent it spinning through the air. It landed amongst the reeds, and the green blood swallowed the red with a soft splash. Ariane did not remember climbing from her horse. Perhaps she'd fallen. She did not remember that either. Yet she found herself on her hands and feet in the sand, shaking and sobbing and retching up her supper. "No," was all she could think. "No, no one was to be hurt. It was all planned. I was so careful." She heard Ariohotar roar,
"After him! He must not escape! After him!"
Marcella was on the ground, wailing, shaking, her pale face in her hands, blood streaming through her fingers. Ariane did not understand. Men were scrambling onto horses, whilst others swarmed over her and her companions. But none of it made sense. She had fallen into a dream, some terrible red nightmare. "This cannot be real. I will wake soon and laugh at my night terrors." When they sought to bind her hands behind her back, she did not resist. One of the guardsmen jerked her to her feet. He wore her father's collars. Another bent and seized the throwing knife inside her boot, a gift from her cousin, Lady Nim. Eriahotar took it from the man and frowned at it.
"The prince said, 'I must bring you back to Sunspear,' he announced.
His cheeks and brow were freckled with the blood of Ares Hokart.
"'I'm sorry, little princess.'
Ariane raised a tear-streaked face.
"'How could he know?' she asked the captain. "'I was so careful. How could he know?'
"'Someone told,' Hotar shrugged. "'Someone always tells.'
Aria. Each night before sleep, she murmured her prayer into her pillow.
"'Sir Gregor,' it went. "'Dunstan, Rafe the Sweetling, Sir Ilan, Sir Merrin, Queen Cersei.'
She would have whispered the names of the Freys of the Crossing, too, if she had known them.
"'One day I'll know,' she told herself, "'and then I'll kill them all.'
No whisper was too faint to be heard in the house of black and white.
"'A child,' said the kindly man one day, "'what are those names you whisper of a night?' "'I don't whisper any names,' she said. "'You lie,' he said. "'All men lie when they are afraid. "'Some tell many lies, some but a few. "'Some have only one great lie.' They tell so often that they almost come to believe it, though some small part of them will always know that it is still a lie, and that will show upon their faces. Tell me of these names. She chewed her lip. The names don't matter. They do, the kindly man insisted. Tell me, a child. Tell me, or we will turn you out, she heard. They're people I hate. I want them to die. We hear many such prayers in this house. I know, said Arya.
Jaqen H'ghar had granted three of her prayers once.
All I had to do was whisper.
Is that why you have come to us? The kindly man went on. To learn our arts so that you may kill these men you hate? Arya did not know how to answer that.
Maybe.
Then you have come to the wrong place. It is not for you to say who shall live and who shall die. That gift belongs to him of many faces. We are but his servants, sworn to do his will. Oh! Arya glanced at the statues that stood along the walls, candles glimmering around their feet.
Oh, which god is he?
Why, all of them, said the priest in black and white. He never told her his name. Neither did the waif, the little girl with the big eyes and hollow face, who reminded her of another little girl named Weasel. Like Arya, the waif lived below the temple, along with three acolytes, two serving men, and a cook named Uma. Uma liked to talk as she worked, but Arya could not understand a word she said. The others had no names, or did not choose to share them. One serving man was very old, his back bent like a bow. The second was red-faced, with hair growing from his ears. She took them both for mutes until she heard them praying. The acolytes were younger. The eldest was her father's age. The other two could not have been much older than Sansa, who had been her sister. The acolytes wore black and white, too, but their robes had no cowls, and were black on the left side and white on the right. With the kindly man and the waif, it was the opposite. Arya was given servant's garb, a tunic of undyed wool, baggy breeches, linen small clothes, cloth slippers for her feet. Only the kindly man knew the common tongue. "Who are you?" he would ask her every day.
No one, she would answer.
She who had been Arya of House Stark, Arya Underfoot, Arya Horseface. She had been Arya and Weasel, too, and Squab and Salty. Nan the Cupbearer, a grey mouse, a sheep, the ghost of Harrenhal. But not for true. Not in her heart of hearts. In there she was Arya of Winterfell, the daughter of Lord Eddard Stark and Lady Catelyn, who had once had brothers named Rob and Bran and Rickon, a sister named Sansa, a direwolf called Nymeria, a half-brother named Jon Snow. In there she was someone. But that was not the answer that he wanted. Without a common language, Arya had no way of talking to the others. She listened to them, though, and repeated the words she heard to herself as she went about her work. Though the youngest acolyte was blind, he had charge of the candles. He would walk the temple in soft slippers, surrounded by the murmurings of the old women who came each day to pray. Even without eyes, he always knew which candles had gone out. "He has the scent to guide him," the kindly man explained, "and the air is warmer where a candle burns." He told Arya to close her eyes and try it for herself. They prayed at dawn before they broke their fast, kneeling around the still black pool. Some days the kindly man led the prayer, other days it was the waif. Arya only knew a few words of Bravassi, the ones that were the same in High Valyrian. So she prayed her own prayer to the many-faced god, the one that went,
"Sir Gregor, Donson, Wraith the Sweetling, Sir Ilion, Sir Meryn, Queen Cersei."
She prayed in silence. If the many-faced god was a proper god, he would hear her. Worshippers came to the House of Black and White every day. Most came alone and sat alone. They lit candles at one altar or another, prayed beside the pool, and sometimes wept. A few drank from the black cup and went to sleep. More did not drink. There were no services, no songs, no paeans of praise to please the god. The temple was never full. From time to time a worshipper would ask to see a priest, and the kindly man or the waif would take him down into the sanctum. But that did not happen often. 30 different guards stood along the walls, surrounded by their little lights. The weeping woman was the favourite of old women, Arya saw. Rich men preferred the Lion of Night, poor men the Hooded Wayfarer. Soldiers lit candles to Bacchalon, the Pale Child. Sailors to Moon-Pale Maiden and the Merlin King. The stranger had his shrine as well, though hardly anyone ever came to him. Most of the time only a single candle stood flickering at his feet. The kindly man said it did not matter. He has many faces and many ears to hear. The knoll on which the temple stood was honeycombed with passageways hewn from the rock. The priests and acolytes had their sleeping cells on the first level. Arya and the servants on the second. The lowest level was forbidden to all save the priests. That was where the holy sanctum lay. When she was not working, Arya was free to wander as she would amongst the vaults and storerooms, so long as she did not leave the temple, nor descend to the third cellar. She found a room full of weapons and armour, ornate helms and curious old breastplates, long swords, daggers and dirks, crossbows and tall spears with leaf-shaped heads. Another vault was crammed with clothing, thick furs and splendid silks in 50 colours, next to piles of foul-smelling rags and threadbare rough-spuns.
"There must be treasure chambers, too,"
Arya decided. She pictured stacks of golden plates, bags of silver coins, sapphires blue as the sea, ropes of fat green pearls. One day the kindly man came on her unexpectedly and asked what she was doing. She told him that she had gotten lost.
"You lie. Worse, you lie poorly. Who are you?"
"Hat, no one."
"Another lie," he sighed.
Whis would have beaten her bloody if he'd caught her in a lie. But it was different in the House of Black and White. When she was helping in the kitchen,
Uma would sometimes smack her with her spoon if she got in the way, but no one else ever raised a hand to her.
They only raise their hands to kill, she thought.
She got along well enough with the cook. Uma would slap a knife into her hand and point at an onion, and Arya would chop it. Uma would shove her toward a mound of dough, and Arya would knead it, until the cook said, stop. Stop was the first Bravasi word she learned. Uma would hand her a fish, and Arya would bone it and fillet it and roll it in the nuts the cook was crushing. The brackish waters that surrounded Bravas teemed with fish and shellfish, of every sort, the kindly man explained. A slow brown river entered the lagoon from the south, wandering through a wide expanse of reeds, tidal pools, and mudflats. Clams and cockles abounded thereabouts, mussels and muskfish, frogs and turtles, mud crabs and leopard crabs, and climber crabs, red eels, black eels, striped eels, lampreys and oysters, all made frequent appearances on the carved wooden table where the servants of the many-faced god took their meals. Some nights Uma spiced the fish with sea salt and cracked peppercorns, or cooked the eels with chopped garlic. Once in a great while the cook would even use some saffron.
Hot pie would have liked it here, Arya thought.
Supper was her favourite time. It had been a long while since Arya had gone to sleep every night with a full belly. Some nights the kindly man would allow her to ask him questions. Once she asked him why the people who came to the temple always seemed so peaceful. Back home, people were scared to die. She remembered how that pimply squire had wept when she stabbed him in the belly, and the way Sir Amory Lorch had begged when the goat had him thrown in the bear pit. She remembered the village by the god's eye, and the way the villagers shrieked and screamed and whimpered whenever the tickler started asking after gold.
"Death is not the worst thing," the kindly man replied. "It is his gift to us, an end to want and pain. On the day that we are born, the many-faced god sends each of us a dark angel to walk through life beside us. When our sins and our sufferings grow too great to be borne, the angel takes us by the hand to lead us to the nightlands, where the stars burn ever bright. Those who come to drink from the black cup are looking for their angels. If they are afraid, the candles soothe them. When you smell our candles burning, what does it make you think of, my child?"
Winterfell, she might have said. "I smell snow and smoke and pine needles. I smell the stables. I smell Hodar laughing, and John and Rob battling in the yard, and Sansa singing about some stupid lady fair. I smell the crypts where the stone kings sit. I smell hot bread baking. I smell the godswood. I smell my wolf. I smell her fur, almost as if she were still beside me. I don't smell anything," she said,
to see what he would say.
"You lie," he said, "but you may keep your secrets if you wish. Arya of House Stark." He only called her that when she displeased him. "You know that you may leave this place. You are not one of us, not yet. You may go home any time you wish."
"You told me that if I left, I couldn't come back."
"Just so."
Those words made her sad.
"Sirio used to say that too,"
Arya remembered.
"He said it all the time."
Sirio Farrell had taught her needlework and died for her.
"I don't want to leave."
"Then stay. But remember, the House of Black and White is not a home for orphans. All men must serve beneath this roof. Volar Dehaerys is how we say it here. Remain if you will, but know that we shall require your obedience at all times and in all things. If you cannot obey, you must depart."
"I can obey."
"We shall see." She had other tasks beside helping Uma. She swept the temple floors. She served and poured at meals. She sorted piles of dead men's clothing, emptied their purses, and counted out stacks of queer coins. Every morning she walked beside the kindly man as he made his circuit of the temple to find the dead.
"Silent as a shadow,"
she would tell herself, remembering Sirio. She carried a lantern with thick iron shutters. At each alcove she would open the shutter crack to look for corpses. The dead were never hard to find. They came to the house of black and white, prayed for an hour or a day or a year, drank sweet, dark water from the pool, and stretched out on a stone bed behind one god or another. They closed their eyes and slept, and never woke.
The gift of the many-faced god takes myriad forms, the kindly man told her, but here it is always gentle.
When they found a body, he would say a prayer and make certain life had fled. And Arya would fetch the serving men, whose task it was to carry the dead down to the vaults. There acolytes would strip and wash the bodies. The dead men's clothes and coins and valuables went into a bin for sorting. Their cold flesh would be taken to the lower sanctum, where only the priest could go. What happened in there, Arya was not allowed to know. Once, as she was eating her supper, a terrible suspicion seized hold of her, and she put down her knife and stared suspiciously at a slice of pale white meat. The kindly man saw the horror on her face.
"It is pork, child," he told her. "Only pork."
Her bed was stone and reminded her of Harrenhal and the bed she'd slept in when scrubbing steps for Whis. The mattress was stuffed with rags instead of straw, which made it lumpier than the one she'd had at Harrenhal, but less stretchy too. She was allowed as many blankets as she wished, thick woolen blankets, red and green and plaid, and her cell was hers alone. She kept her treasures there, the silver fork and floppy hat and fingerless gloves given her by the sailors on the Titan's Daughter, her dagger, boots and belt, her small store of coins, the clothes she had been wearing, and needle. Though her duties left her little time for needlework, she practiced when she could, dueling with her shadow by the light of a blue candle. One night the waif happened to be passing and saw Arya at her swordplay. The girl did not say a word, but the next day the kindly man walked Arya back to her cell.
"You need to rid yourself of all this," he said of her treasures.
Arya felt stricken.
"They're mine."
"And who are you?"
"No one."
He picked up her silver fork.
"This belongs to Arya of House Stark. All these things belong to her. There is no place for them here. There is no place for her. Hers is too proud a name, and we have no room for pride. We are servants here."
"I serve,"
she said, wounded. She liked the silver fork.
"You play at being a servant, but in your heart you are a lord's daughter. You have taken other names, but you wore them as lightly as you might wear a gown. Under them was always Arya."
"I don't wear gowns. You can't fight in a stupid gown."
"Why would you wish to fight? Are you some bravo, strutting through the alleys, spoiling for blood?" He sighed. "Before you drink from the cold cup, you must offer up all you are to him of many faces, your body, your soul, yourself. If you cannot bring yourself to do that, you must leave this place. The iron coin has paid your passage here. From this point, you must pay your own way, and the cost is dear."
"I don't have any gold."
"What we offer cannot be bought with gold. The cost is all of you."
Men take many paths through this veil of tears and pain. Ours is the hardest. Few are made to walk it. It takes uncommon strength of body and spirit, and a heart both hard and strong. I have a hole where my heart should be, she thought, and nowhere else to go.
I'm strong. As strong as you. I'm hard.
You believe this is the only place for you? It was as if he'd heard her thoughts. You are wrong in that. You would find a softer service in the household of some merchant. You would sooner be a courtesan and have songs sung of your beauty. Speak the word, and we will send you to the Black Pearl, or the Daughter of the Dusk. You will sleep on rose petals, and wear silken skirts that rustle when you walk, and great lords will beggar themselves for your maiden's blood. Or if it is marriage and children you desire, tell me, and we shall find a husband for you. Some honest apprentice boy, a rich old man, a seafarer, whatever you desire.
She wanted none of that. Wordless, she shook her head.
Is it Westeros you dream of, child? Luco Prestaine's Lady Bright leaves upon the morrow for Gulltown, Duskendale, King's Landing, and Tyrosh. Shall we find you passage on her?
I only just came from Westeros.
Sometimes it seemed 1,000 years since she had fled King's Landing, and sometimes it seemed like only yesterday. But she knew she could not go back.
I'll go, if you don't want me. But I won't go there.
My wants do not matter, said the kindly man. It may be that the many-faced God has led you here to be his instrument. And when I look at you, I see a child. And worse, a girl child. Many have served him of many faces through the centuries, but only a few of his servants have been women. Women bring life into the world. We bring the gift of death. No one can do both.
He's trying to scare me away, Arya thought, the way he did with the worm. I don't care about that.
You should. Stay, and the many-faced god will take your ears, your nose, your tongue. He will take your sad grey eyes that have seen so much. He will take your hands, your feet, your arms and legs, your private parts. He will take your hopes and dreams, your loves and hates. Those who enter his service must give up all that makes them who they are. Can you do that? He cupped her chin and gazed deep into her eyes,
so deep it made her shiver.
No, he said, I do not think you can.
Arya knocked his hand away.
I could if I wanted to.
So says Arya of Harstark, eater of grave worms.
I can give up anything I want.
He gestured at her treasures. Then start with these.
That night after supper, Arya went back to her cell and took off her robe and whispered her names. But sleep refused to take her. She tossed on her mattress, stuffed with rags, gnawing on her lip. She could feel the hole inside her, where her heart had been. In the black of night she rose again, donned the clothes she'd worn from Westeros, and buckled on her sword belt. Needle hung over one hip, her dagger from the other. With her floppy hat on her head, her fingerless gloves tucked into her belt, and her silver fork in one hand, she went stealing up the steps.
There is no place here for Arya of House Stark, she was thinking.
Arya's place was Winterfell, only Winterfell was gone.
When the snows fall and the white winds blow, the lone wolf dies, but the pack survives.
She had no pack, though. They had killed her pack, Sir Ilyen and Sir Meryn and the Queen, and when she tried to make a new one, all of them ran off, Hutpie and Gendry and Yoren, and Lummy Greenhands, even Harwin, who had been her father's man. She shoved through the doors, out into the night. It was the first time she had been outside since entering the temple. The sky was overcast, and fog covered the ground like a frayed grey blanket. Off to her right she heard paddling from the canal. Bravos, the secret city, she thought. The name seemed very apt. She crept down the steep steps to the covered dock, the mist swirling round her feet. It was so foggy she could not see the water, but she heard it lapping softly at stone pilings. In the distance, a light glowed through the gloom. The night fire at the Temple of the Red Priest, she thought. At the water's edge she stopped, the silver fork in hand. It was real silver, solid through and through.
It's not my fork. It was Salty that he gave it to.
She tossed it underhand, heard the soft plop as it sank below the water. Her floppy hat went next, then the gloves. They were Salty's, too. She emptied her pouch into her palm, 5 silver stags, 9 copper stars, some pennies and halfpennies and groats. She scattered them across the water. Next, her boots. They made the loudest splash. Her dagger followed, the one she'd gotten off the archer, who begged the hound for mercy. Her sword belt went into the canal, her cloak, tunic, breeches, small clothes, all of it, all but needle. She stood on the end of the dock, pale and goose-fleshed and shivering in the fog. In her hand, Needle seemed to whisper to her.
"Stick them with a pointy end," it said, "and don't tell Sansa."
Mickon's mark was on the blade.
"It's just a sword."
If she needed a sword, there were 100 under the temple. Needle was too small to be a proper sword. It was hardly more than a toy. She had been a stupid little girl when John had it made for her.
"It's just a sword," she said aloud this time.
But it wasn't. Needle was Rob and Bran and Rickon, her mother and her father, even Sansa. Needle was Winterfell's grey walls and the laughter of its people. Needle was the summer snows, old man's stories, the heart tree with its red leaves and scary face, the warm earthy smell of the glass gardens, the sound of the north wind rattling the shutters of her room. Needle was Jon Snow's smile.
"He used to mess my hair, and he called me Little Sister,"
she remembered, and suddenly there were tears in her eyes. Polliver had stolen the sword from her when the Mountain's men took her captive, but when she and the Hound walked into the inn at the crossroads, there it was.
"The guards wanted me to have it."
Not the 7, nor him of many faces, but her father's guards, the old guards of the north.
"The many-faced god can have the rest," she thought, "but he can't have this."
She padded up the steps as naked as her name day, clutching Needle. Halfway up, one of the stones rocked beneath her feet. Arya knelt and dug around its edges with her fingers. It would not move at first, but she persisted, picking at the crumbling mortar with her nails. Finally the stone shifted. She grunted and got both hands in and pulled. A crack opened before her.
"You'll be safe here," she told Needle. "No one will know where you are but me."
She pushed the sword and sheath behind the step, then shoved the stone back into place, so it looked like all the other stones. As she climbed back to the temple, she counted steps, so she would know where to find the sword again. One day she might have need of it.
"One day,"
she whispered to herself. She never told the kindly man what she had done, yet he knew. The next night he came to her cell after supper.
"Child," he said, "come sit with me. I have a tale to tell you."
"What kind of tale?"
she asked, weary.
"The tale of our beginnings. If you would be one of us, you had best know who we are and how we came to be."
Men may whisper of the faceless men of Braavos, but we are older than the secret city. Before the Titan rose, before the unmasking of Euthyra, before the founding